Vin Scully has joined us on Sports Byline. Just before the break, we talked a little bit about the team leaving Brooklyn. What was the expectation? What were the thoughts about going to the West Coast? Because as you know, New York is not like any other place, and the West Coast really wasn't anything like the East Coast was.
No, in fact, there were several relevant thoughts about it. The first thought was a Dodger decision. They're coming out to play in Los Angeles in 1958, and they're not even going to play in a baseball park. They're going to play in a stadium that was built for track and field and football. But the big decision really was, are they going to come out with a Dodger team that was just about over the hill, or would they come out with young rookies and hope to build on that? Well, a wise decision was made to go with the older players whose names were somewhat familiar to the West Coast baseball fans. And that turned out to be a very good decision. Number two, the team itself came in seventh in an eight-team league in 1958. That's not a good way to begin a love affair. However, in 1959, two big things occurred. Number one was the arrival of the transistor radio. And the other was the Dodgers not only won the pennant, they won the World Series. That was a record. No team finishing seventh the year before ever came back the following year and won the World Series. So the decision to go with the older players, the transistor radio, and the miracle win in 59, those were the big breaks. Plus a political break. Walter O'Malley always felt the referendum, which really was going to approve the Dodgers to get the land to build their own stadium. The referendum was won, I'll say, by the Dodgers by only 25,000 votes. Walter O'Malley always felt that the Dodgers, the day of the referendum, were in Chicago playing the Cubs on a gray, cold, wintry day. A lot of balls were hit that might have been home runs, and because the wind was blowing in, they were nullified. The Dodgers won that game, and Mr. O'Malley's always felt that the Dodgers winning that game swayed the referendum, so they won by 25,000. So when you look back over those couple of years, a lot of things had to happen in order for the team to begin to be what it is today.
Southern California fans and certainly listeners to the radio took to you immediately. And because the L.A. Memorial Coliseum was so big, they used to bring those transistor radios to the stadium, I understand. But it really caused havoc for the radio and television engineers because they had difficulty compensating for the sound of your play-by-play reverberating through the stands at the Dodger home games. That must have been something. Was it an echo for you in the broadcast booth?
Oh, yes, sometimes. I mean, your voice would come back to almost haunt you a little bit. But as I learned to play with the radio, I began to have fun with the fans. I had the fans one night. I was doing a game, and it was early in the game, and nothing had happened. And I was thumbing through the Red Book, which featured all of the umpires, and the Green Book. And I came across the fact that one of the umpires, his name was Frank Sicori, and it happened to be his birthday. And so I said to the people with the transistors, we could set a record here tonight if we all sang happy birthday to an umpire. I don't think that's ever been done. And sure enough, after we came out of commercial, I counted 1, 2, 3, and this large crowd at the Coliseum immediately sang out happy birthday. And it was a wonderful moment, including a great moment for Frank Sicori. And from that time on, although I tried not to overdo it, I would occasionally talk directly to the people in the ballpark, and we had a marvelous relationship. So one of the great breaks that I had was to have a championship team and the transistor radio arrive in a ballpark that was not made for baseball. So the transistor was almost a necessary part of the equipment for the fan, besides a pencil and a scorecard. And it all worked out exceptionally well.
One of the toughest days in your broadcasting career with the Dodgers came in 1993 as your broadcasting partner, Don Drysdale, former Dodger great, He dies in his hotel room following a heart attack before the game against the Expos. And you and your broadcasting team could not announce it because the family had not been notified of this. But when you were able to announce the news, you went on the air saying, "Never have I been asked to make an announcement that hurts me as much as this one. And I say it to you as best I can with a broken heart." Many times it's hard for announcers to fight through things that are real life situations, but you did it with such great aplomb. How difficult was that for you, Vin?
Oh, it was extremely difficult, especially it was not a shock as far as the announcement is concerned. The shock, of course, was hearing the news. We took the team bus. Gary Doggett and I took the team bus to the ballpark. Don wasn't on the bus, but that didn't mean anything. A lot of times we'll take cabs instead of going with the team bus. And even though I didn't see Don in the press room or in the clubhouse before the game, again, he had pitched in Montreal. He was very famous in Montreal. And I assume, well, he's probably doing a radio or a TV interview somewhere. However, by the time we went on the air, I was concerned. Now, in those days, I would do the first three innings on television, the middle three innings on radio, and then the last three innings on television. Don's job, he would do the middle three innings on television. So the game started, and I'm anxiously looking over at the radio booth, and there is no Don. And my dear friend Billy DeLurie, who was the Dodgers' traveling secretary, suddenly came into the booth, and his face was ashen. And we went to commercial, and I said, "What's wrong?" And Billy just said, "I'll never forget, he's dead." And when he said that, I could barely breathe. And he explained how they rang the room, and they finally had to break the door down, and there was Don. And he said, "You can't say anything about it because his wife, Ann, is unaware of it. And until she knows, we don't want her to be shocked hearing it over the television." I said, "Fine, I'll wait." Meanwhile, as I'm doing each of the first three innings, I'm thinking, come the fourth inning, Don's mom and dad are going to be expecting to hear him take over and do the next three innings. And so I'm overwhelmed by all of these thoughts, meanwhile trying to do the best I can as far as the game is concerned. And whenever it came, but it did come before the fourth inning, Billy came back in and said, "They have reached Ann." And Ann had been with Don's daughter, and it was her birthday, and they were gathering a birthday cake, and they were going back to the apartment to celebrate. And as I understand it, Ann's mom was the one who told her that Don had passed away. So once they knew, then they said to me, "Okay, you can make the announcement." And that's what came out of my mouth, what you just mentioned.
Your illustrious career included, of course, beyond the Dodgers, working with CBS Network and NBC Network as well. And I remember seeing you in the stadium on that day in 1982. It was the NFC championship game. And you made one of the most famous NFL calls in that game between the Dallas Cowboys and the San Francisco 49ers. You said, "Montana, looking, throwing in the end zone. Clark caught it. Dwight Clark, it's a madhouse at Candlestick." Just a wonderful football game, and you captured the moment exactly as it was.
It was a wild moment. I was working with a wonderful former coach and analyst, Hank Stram, and I think we did a pretty good job on that game, and it was a very excitable moment. And even after the catch, and the Niners were now in front, Dallas got the ball back, and they started to work down the field. And the thought was, they're still maybe able to come back and pull it out. I don't remember exactly, but I do know Danny White was the quarterback. Somebody fumbled, I believe, and the Niners recovered, and that was literally the end of the game. But it was a tremendous game. The crowd, as usual, completely captivated me. And when I got on the airplane to fly back home, I was emotionally spent. And I thought to myself, you know, that was such a great game. It might very well be the game you'd like to walk away from and end your career on football. And as I flew the small mileage from San Francisco to Los Angeles, I pretty much made up my mind that that was it. And when I came home, my children were all excited. What a great game. And I said, yes, it was. But I really feel in my heart that's going to be my last game. And it was. And when I first informed my representative, who told CBS, they said, oh, listen, he's just tired. He'll get the feeling and the drive to come back. But it never came back. I felt that was the perfect time to walk off the football stage.
As dramatic as that moment was in football, I was down at Dodgers Stadium, 1988, the World Series, Oakland A's against the Los Angeles Dodgers, and I'll never forget game number one. And I happen to be able to hear your broadcast as Kirk Gibson comes out of the dugout and comes to the field against Dennis Eckersley. Tell me about the call, if you can repeat it for me, and also tell me about that moment for you as you look over all the great moments that you've seen in baseball.
Well, a lot of people have asked me how I would rank the home run, and I guess it was the most theatrical home run I have ever encountered. I'll tell you why. It was the middle of the ninth inning. We were in commercial, the bottom of the ninth coming up, the Dodgers trailing, and I said to the truck where the producer and the director were, and I knew they were very busy, because when you're doing a network show, let's say in California, the producer is checking with New York so that at the end of the game, you've heard them say something like, 60 Minutes will be on at 7 p.m. Eastern time. Meanwhile, regular programming in California. They have to inform the viewers exactly what's coming up following the game. So I knew they were very busy doing that, but I took the risk of interrupting them during the commercial. And I just said, do me a favor, follow me when we come out of commercial. And the answer was okay. So when we came out of commercial, the usual blimp shot from the heavens down showing the stadium. And my first thought was, and certainly I'd not planned it except for that moment, and I said, if you were with us here in the ballpark, the first thing you would do was take your field glasses and look in the Dodger dugout. Wham! There was a close-up of the dugout, and the camera panned the length of the dugout. And when it finished, I said, obviously, Kirk Gibson is not in the dugout. Obviously, he will not play in tonight's game. Well, in the Dodger dressing room, Gibson, who told the story later on, was sitting in the trainer's room, and he had two large bags of ice, one on each leg. And he, too, was watching the television screen. And when I said, obviously, Kirk Gibson will not be able to play tonight, it triggered some emotion in Kirk Gibson. And, of course, he was full of emotion having been a football player. And he suddenly hollered at the screen, fertilizer. He actually used another word. And he hurled the ice off his legs. He hollered to the clubhouse man, tell Tommy I'll be right down. And while he was throwing on his baseball pants and shoes, down on the field, Mike Davis, a fine Dodger outfielder, was at the plate. Mike was an aggressive hitter and did something that you wouldn't expect him to do too often. He actually got a walk. Anyway, time was consumed, and that allowed Gibson to get dressed, come down the runway, and I remember out of the corner of my eye seeing Kirk suddenly coming up the steps with a bat, using the bat as a cane. And I remember saying, well, look who's here. And there was Gibby. The crowd went bananas. And, of course, as you know, he hit the home run.
Ben, I want to thank you very, very much for sharing your life and your career with us. It was an illustrious one and has been and continues. And I just want to say that what you did is that you brought the games, not just baseball, but all the games to life. And you did it in such a wonderful visual way for those that were listening to it on radio or even watching it on television. It was something that they won't forget, and I know I won't as well. Thank you, Vin Scully, for joining us on Sports Byline.
Thank you, Ron. I'm honored and delighted to have played a small part in this long, historic, and wonderful series.
Vin Scully with us on Sports Byline. We continue on America's Sports Talk Show.